Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Rangers America, episode 14, where we bring you all the news you can handle about what size boot the government is going to be stomping on your rights with today. I am your host, Xenovalent. I have no co-hosts with me today because I am recording out of schedule from what our normal recording schedule is. So there's nobody else to say hi or howdy or any of that stuff right now. If you want to join in, or if you want to send me a story that you think should be reported on the show, go ahead and send that in to xenovalent@aim.com, and I will get it on the next show that we have recorded. We do try to stick to an every 2 weeks recording schedule, so you should be able to hear it pretty quickly. And now, let's get right into the news stories. Our first story is about why civil liberties groups are happy about Obama detaining people. It comes to us from thefastertimes.com. President Obama's decision last week not to seek legislation that would allow him to detain terror suspects indefinitely, but instead to continue to do so without such legislation, as did his predecessor, might have been expected to elicit condemnation from civil liberties advocates. As the liberal outlet The Raw Story put it, Obama has quietly decided to bypass Congress and allow the indefinite detention of terrorist suspects without charges. The move has sparked serious concern among civil liberties advocates. Such a decision allows the president to unilaterally hold combatants without habeas corpus. But, in fact, while civil liberties groups are, of course, concerned about indefinite detention, the question in this case is not whether suspects will be indefinitely detained, but under what authority. And there are two ways to look at this development, as evidenced by the headlines in the New York Times and the Washington Post. While civil liberties groups are obviously against using current law to detain people indefinitely, they're even more opposed to codifying indefinite detention as the law of the land. At the moment, the Obama administration, like its predecessor, cites the power granted it under a congressional resolution passed after 9/11, authorizing the president to use force against al-Qaeda and the Taliban. What that resolution actually allows the executive to detain... Whether that resolution actually allows the executive to detain suspects indefinitely is obviously up for serious debate and continues to be worked out by the courts. But as the ACLU put it in an email to supporters Tuesday entitled, "Thanks to you, nothing happened." Legislation or an executive order on indefinite detention would have made it more permanent and harder to end. And the ACLU credits the pressure its members put on Congress and the White House with bringing about Obama's decision not to take such a definitive step. A less diplomatic take on why this is a positive development for civil liberties advocates comes from Glenn Greenwald, who writes that congressional legislation might have been much broader and far-reaching than anything the White House had in mind. When the Obama administration and Congress are at odds, it is Congress demanding greater powers of executive detention, as happened when Congress blocked Obama from transferring Guantanamo detainees to the U.S. Any process that lets Lindsey Graham, Joe Lieberman, and Dianne Feinstein anywhere near presidential detention powers is one that is to be avoided at all costs. It is a very good thing that the Congress is not going to write a new law authorizing presidential preventative detentions. It's unlikely that Congress would write such a law absent a request from Obama, as only a direct request from him would give political cover to enough Democrats to support it. And this leaves the open door for Congress to restrict presidential detention powers if advocates are able to push them in that direction. Meanwhile, the courts will continue sorting out how broad the administration's detention powers are, a process that has not gone well for the White House thus far. And it should be noted that certain Obama supporters believe that he wants the courts to limit his powers because though he supports limited executive power, he feels that politically he can't curtail his own detention powers. Well, I think one of the things we need to consider in relation to this story is that the Constitution to the United States says absolutely nothing about there being any difference between a citizen of the United States and the people of the world in general. Every time that people are mentioned in relation to the government, it is, you know, it's separated to the people, not citizens of the United States or, you know, anything about non-citizens. It's just the people, and then how the government is intended to deal with them. So, I think that limits, constitutionally, the power that the president has to detain people. You know, just because they're not citizens doesn't mean they don't have the right to a trial by jury, to a speedy trial, all of those things. And it did mention in the story habeas corpus, which is, you know, one of the rules. It's been suspended in wartime previously. If you actually look very carefully, none of those previous suspensions have ever been officially ended. So that's something else that somebody eventually might want to look at. But I think we have much more pressing issues at the moment. Okay, on to our next story. Banks and civil rights advocates to spar over new agency. This one comes to us from NASDAQ.com. Civil rights advocates and banking industry representatives were set to spar over draft legislation to create the Consumer Financial Protection Agency in a U.S. House hearing Wednesday. Civil rights advocates will cite the recent history of unchecked predatory and discriminatory lending in black and Hispanic neighborhoods to argue the agency should have authority to enforce fair lending laws as well as the Community Reinvestment Act. Examples of the financial abusers targeting racial and ethnic minorities abound and can be found throughout the mortgage arena, where predatory lenders consistently targeted African Americans and others, Hillary O. Shelton, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People Senior Vice President, will say in prepared testimony before the House Financial Services Committee. In a second panel of witnesses, banking industry representatives will argue that such laws do not belong with the proposed agency. They will also raise a host of separate concerns about the agency. A current draft bill to create the new agency would leave the enforcement of the CRA, enacted three decades ago to ensure banks lend to underserved communities, with banks' prudential regulators. That's prudential as in the adjective prudential, not the insurance company. But the agency would assume enforcement of fair lending laws. Janice Bowler, a deputy director at the National Council of La Raza, will argue that CRA should be put under the new agency's umbrella so the agency can judge whether banks are offering a full range of credit products in poorer neighborhoods. Without such an assessment, favorable credit products may be developed but will remain unavailable in entire neighborhoods, Bowler will say in prepared remarks. Banking industry representatives will offer praise for changes made to the proposed agency that were outlined in the draft bill circulated last week. For example, House Financial Services Chairman Barney Frank, D. Mass, scrapped the mandate that banks offer simpler, plain vanilla products to consumers. He also proposed a funding mechanism for the new agency that banks believe is fairer because it would rely on assessments from the non-bank sector. However, the industry remains fiercely opposed to language that would allow stronger state laws to trump the rules written by the new agency, essentially gutting federal preemption for national banks. We believe that without such preemption, we will have a patchwork of state and even local laws that will confuse consumers, greatly increase the cost of financial services, and serve as a strong disincentive to create new products of value to consumers. American Bankers Association President Edward L. Yingling will say in prepared remarks, Community Banker R. Michael S. Menzies will argue that a bank's prudential regulator, not the CFPA, should assume enforcement of the new agency's rules. He also contends that the new agency should share its rule-writing authority with the bank's prudential regulators. If the CFPA is not equally interested in the safety and soundness of the lender, it is likely to promulgate unnecessarily burdensome or contrary rules to those issued by the prudential regulator. Menzies, who is president and chief executive officer of Easton Bank and Trust Company, will say in testimony. I'm not really sure how this one should go. There's, certainly opportunity in some cases for a bank to, set an interest rate artificially high in some cases. They may do that because they feel that the person they're lending to is a bad risk and they want to recoup as much of their money as possible in the shortest amount of time possible. But they can also do that basically under a plan to foreclose on lower income properties. At that point, the property becomes owned by the bank and the bank can resell it. And they, may have a deal with somebody to fix up properties cheaply so that they can make more money. So I do think there does need to be regulation of the banking industry to prevent that kind of thing. But where that regulation belongs and how it should be done, I'm not real sure about that. Okay, on to our next story. Supreme Court justices will weigh challenges to gun laws. From the New York Times. The Supreme Court announced on Wednesday that it would decide whether state and local gun control laws may be challenged under the Second Amendment. The court also agreed to hear 9 other cases from among those that had piled up over its summer break, including one concerning the constitutionality of an anti-terrorism law that is a favorite tool of federal prosecutors. The Second Amendment case, McDonald v. Chicago, addresses a question that was left open last year when the court decided that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to own firearms rather than a collective right tied to state militias. Last year's decision, District of Columbia v. Heller, concerned only federal laws and struck down parts of the gun control law in the District of Columbia, a federal enclave. The court ruled that the law violated the Second Amendment by barring law-abiding people from keeping guns in their homes for self-defense. The new case was brought by residents of Chicago, who say their city's handgun ban is identical to the one struck down in Heller. Several Supreme Court decisions, all more than a century old, have said that the Second Amendment does not apply to the states. In June, the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit in Chicago affirmed the dismissal of the new case, saying it was up to the Supreme Court to overrule its own precedent if it wished to do so. Chief Judge Frank H. Easterbrook, writing for a unanimous three-judge panel of the appeals court, added that it was not certain whether and how the Supreme Court might apply the Second Amendment to the states. The Supreme Court has ruled that most but not all of the protections of the Bill of Rights apply to the states, thanks to the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, one of the post-Civil War amendments. Exceptions include the Fifth Amendment's requirement of indictment by a grand jury and Eighth Amendment's ban on excessive bail. Most legal scholars expect the court to apply the Second Amendment to the states, but many of them are urging the court to take an unusual route to that result. Rather than continuing to rely on the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause, the court should, these scholars say, look to the amendment's Privileges or Immunities Clause, which says that no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of the citizens of the United States. There is some evidence that the amendment's writers specifically wanted the clause to apply to allow freed slaves to have guns to defend themselves. Scholars on the right and left believe, moreover, that the clause could play a role in protecting rights not specifically mentioned in the Constitution. A decision that the Second Amendment applies to the states would not answer most questions about what kind of gun laws are vulnerable to challenges under the Second Amendment. In the Heller decision, Justice Antonin Scalia seemed to identify quite a few kinds of laws that are presumptively constitutional. "Nothing, in our opinion," Justice Scalia wrote, "should be taken to cast doubt on long-standing prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill, or laws forbidding the carrying of firearms in sensitive places such as schools and government buildings, or laws imposing conditions and qualifications on the commercial sale of arms." The anti-terrorism law at issue, in a second case that the court agreed to hear, Holder v. Humanitarian Law Project, makes it a crime to provide various kinds of material support to organizations the government says have engaged in terrorist activities. The United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit Court in San Francisco ruled that the laws bans on providing training, service, and some kinds of expert advice and assistance were unconstitutionally vague. The case was brought by people and organizations who sought to provide support for what they said were lawful and nonviolent activities of a Kurdish political party and a Tamil group. The two organizations, the Kurdistan Workers' Party and the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, have been designated as foreign terrorist organizations by the State Department. In its brief asking the Supreme Court to hear the case, the government said the appeals court's decision frustrated a vital part of the nation's effort to fight international terrorism. The brief added that the federal government had charged approximately 120 defendants with violations of the material support law since 2001 and had obtained about 60 convictions under it. The law's challengers filed a separate appeal to the Supreme Court, objecting to another aspect of the appeals court ruling, this one upholding bans on providing support consisting of personnel or of expert advice derived from scientific or technical knowledge. The Supreme Court consolidated that appeal, Humanitarian Law Project v. Holder, with the government's appeal. The material support law resurrects guilt by association and makes it a crime for a human rights group in the U.S. to provide human rights training, David D. Cole, a lawyer for the challengers, said in a statement. Robert Chesney, a law professor at the University of Texas, said the case was extraordinarily important. "The material support law not only provides federal prosecutors with an important tool," he said, "but it may also provide the government with a basis for bringing cases in civilian courts against prisoners detained in Guantanamo Bay." Okay, so there's really two stories in here. One is that the question of an individual right to bear arms is finally going to be addressed by the Supreme Court. Like the article said, it's the cases that have addressed this were all more than a century old. Given the outcome in District of Columbia versus Heller, I think there's a lot of hope that some sanity will be restored to the gun laws in the United States. California's restrictions are insanely strict. New York's restrictions aren't as bad, but they're there. Most of New England has some pretty tough laws. Individual cities in various states have some pretty tough laws. So hopefully this will bring a federal level of investigation to all of those things. So federal ruling on this, I think, will be a good thing. The other part of the article about the material support for terrorist activities, I agree that it's unconstitutionally vague. I don't think guilt by association is something that we want to move forward with. It's much better if we, you know, arrest the people that actually A, committed the acts, and B, planned the acts of terrorism. That kind of thing will keep the people who are actually being violent from being able to repeat their actions while still allowing the people who are just interested in the humanitarian side of things to continue you know, working with and training all of the people that you know, they're interested in training and working with in order to bring justice to those areas. And that's all I'm going to say on that one. Ass Bomber, brought to us by Bruce Schneier's blog. Nobody tell the TSA, but last month, someone tried to assassinate a Saudi prince by exploding a bomb stuffed in his rectum. Not the Saudi prince's rectum, the guy that tried to assassinate the Saudi prince. He pretended to be a repentant militant, when in fact he was a Trojan horse. The resulting explosion ripped Al-Asiri to shreds, but only lightly injured the shocked prince, the target of Al-Asiri's unsuccessful assassination attempt. For years, I have made the joke about Richard Reed. Just be glad he wasn't the underwear bomber. Now, sadly, we have an example of one. Lewis Page, an improvised device disposal operator, tasked in support of the UK mainland police from 2001 to 2004, pointed out that this isn't much of a threat for three reasons. One, you can't stuff a lot of explosives into a body cavity. Two, detonation is, problematic. And three, the human body can stifle an explosion pretty effectively. Think of someone throwing himself on a grenade to save his friends. But whoever accused the TSA of being rational? Hopefully this will not, result in all of us getting body cavity searches every time we fly, like Richard Reed's actions resulting in us having to take off our shoes every time we go through the airport metal detector. It's pretty ridiculous. You know, even putting shoes through the X-ray machine instead of the metal detector is pretty ridiculous. What if I had just made new soles for my shoes that were completely made out of explosives? Okay, that's all I've got on that one. Our next story. Holder hides from Civil Rights Commission. From Examiner.com. Glenn Beck should add this one to his list of stories the New York Times might consider covering. Eric Holder's refusal to answer repeated requests for documents and information on the dismissal of charges against the new Black Panthers by Congress and others. The United States Commission on Civil Rights has sent yet another letter to Mr. Holder. A sham internal investigation was created to divert attention and thwart further inquiries. Unfortunately, the USCR was not intimidated. Among the demands in the new September 30, 2009 letter is the appointment of a special coordinator within the DOJ to expedite requests. The Department of Justice's secretary is evident. Secrecy is evidence of President Obama's sorry lack of a transparent administration. Not in my backyard, so to speak. Holder and the DOJ have ignored dozens of requests over a period of 6 months. The Bush DOJ was front page news for similar attacks. With the Acorn scandal, one might think President Obama would seize any opportunity to demonstrate the change he promised. Granting special status to the new Black Panthers is hardly a positive development for a post-racial, post-Acorn track record. Where's the outrage over Obama's smoke-filled backroom deals? Is that really all there was to this story? Wow. Well, I guess it's good to have a short one in there every now and then. So not much to say about this one. You know, nobody should have special status in the United States. You know, that's part of the whole all men were created equal thing. So hopefully the Commission on Civil Rights will get some results on this one. Okay, on to the next story. U.S. judge refuses to release interrogation documents. From Reuters. A U.S. federal judge refused on Wednesday to release records describing interrogation techniques authorized for overseas use by the CIA, saying it was up to the agency to decide if they should remain secret. U.S. District Judge Alvin Hellerstein ruled against requests by the American Civil Liberties Union to release documents from a total of 580 that included names and dates of when detainees were captured, as well as descriptions of destroyed videotapes that showed CIA interrogations of two suspects. Speaking from the bench, Hellerstein noted that in a post-9/11 world, there was strong pressure for the United States to gather evidence from various sources, and that the courts needed to defer to CIA Director Leon Panetta in assessing whether they should remain secret. He reviewed some of the documents behind closed doors before ruling. Hellerstein ordered the CIA to release one document containing handwritten notes of a CIA employee discussing the destroyed tapes. "We are troubled by the amount of deference he has given to the CIA," ACLU lawyer Alex Abdo told reporters after the hearing. He said the judge was showing too much restraint about an interrogation program that the whole world knows about. In March, the Justice Department disclosed the CIA had destroyed 92 videotapes of harsh interrogation sessions made in 2002 involving two suspects who it said later were subjected to waterboarding. The Justice Department is conducting a separate criminal investigation to see whether the CIA violated any laws when it destroyed the tapes in 2005 during the Bush administration. Well, if you're the government, I don't think you go around destroying videotapes because the actions that are recorded on them are completely innocent. Obviously, there is something going on there. Hopefully, this Justice Department investigation will turn up what it is that was going on, and will be able to bring the perpetrators of any wrongdoing to justice. I mean, they are the Justice Department, that is their purpose. Unfortunately, with judges backing the CIA, that may be a while. So hopefully we'll hear about this one again before too much longer. And hopefully it'll be good news. But I'm not going to hold my breath, because chances of that happening are not all that great. Okay, believe it or not, we have still got more stories for you. And we're going to roll right into the next one. New York to fight terrorism with more street corner cameras. This one comes to us from the Christian Science Monitor. Mayor Bloomberg moves to expand high-tech surveillance to midtown Manhattan. But civil liberties groups are concerned, and some security experts question its value. On the heels of breaking up an alleged bomb terror plot, New York is planning to place high-tech security cameras, license plate readers, and weapons sensors in midtown Manhattan. Office workers and tourists, and possible terrorists, will have cameras watching their every move as they visit Macy's, shop for diamonds at Tiffany & Co., or gawk in Times Square. The apparatus, paid for by some $24 million in Department of Homeland Security funding, will expand a similar effort already underway in Lower Manhattan, where cameras focus on the Federal Reserve, the New York Stock Exchange, and the Brooklyn Bridge. Mayor Michael Bloomberg, announcing the program Sunday, said the goal is to detect terrorism threats and deter pre-operational surveillance. Sensors will try to detect chemical, biological, and radiological threats. but some terrorism experts have questioned whether a camera network will deter terrorists. They also say the sensors are known to give off false positives. Meanwhile, civil rights organizations are concerned that the project will be another encroachment on civil liberties. The fear is that the NYPD, without any oversight or public scrutiny, is creating a massive surveillance system. When we don't know if it's the best use of the $125 million designed to keep us safe, says Donna Lieberman, executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union. The NYCLU has filed two lawsuits to try to get more public information about the program. In March, New York Police Department Commissioner Raymond Kelly indicated in testimony before the City Council that 1,000 police officers are involved in anti-terrorism work daily, and that he hoped to add 500 more cameras to the 500 already installed. But there did not appear to be any discussion at the hearing about whether the effort is worthwhile or what kind of civil rights safeguards might be needed. There are legitimate arguments on all sides here, says Frank Silufu, head of George Washington University's Homeland Security Policy Institute in Washington. What I would like to see is a broader discussion that brings in the average citizen. Probably the largest use of security cameras is in London, which has put what it terms a ring of steel of thousands of security cameras all over the city. But some security experts question their effectiveness. They won't stop any terrorist, says Bruce Schneier, chief security technology officer at BT, formerly British Telecom, and a widely published author on security. None of them is going to look at a camera and say, "I better go get a real job." The only time cameras reduce crime is in parking lots and laundromats, Mr. Schneier says. It only makes sense if the tactics and targets are few, but there are billions of targets ranging from shopping malls to restaurants and dozens of tactics, he adds. However, Brian Jackson, associate director of the Homeland Security Research Program at the Rand Institute in Washington, says the cameras create the possibility for prevention of an attack. He says cameras add a level of concern for the terrorists. Surveillance is one ingredient that gives the terrorists more opportunities to make a mistake and be discovered, says Mr. Jackson. As for using sensors that detect biological and radiological weapons, Mr. Silufo says they often give off false positives or false negatives. They tend to be only successful in events that can be easily contained, like the State of the Union address or conventions, he says. Once they are in a more dynamic environment, I'm not sure where the science is on that. But the science of cameras is progressing fast, raising the possibility that even more Big Brother-like scenarios. Cameras are everywhere, and you can see them, says Schneier. In 10 years, you won't even be able to see them. Well, I think the Ring of Steel, London CCTV camera being brought up is a good thing. Unfortunately, what they did not bring up is that the statistics for crime reduction based on those cameras is very, very poor. Something like one crime per year per 100 cameras that have been prevented based on those. Don't quote me on that because I'm not sure I got the figure right. I do know it's very small. It's in single-digit number of crimes per some number of hundreds of cameras. So I don't think that the cameras themselves will be a significant force in reducing crime or terrorism. The thing is that you need to have some sort of system watching those cameras in order to detect behaviors that seem out of the ordinary. And thus far, we haven't gotten any good algorithmic way to do that, to do it with computers. So, we have to fall back on having humans look at the cameras. And, there simply aren't enough police officers to do that. So I'm personally, I feel that this is going to be a waste of money on the part of the New York City Police Department. Okay, moving on to our next story. And from government inspection of public places to government inspection of private places. City to homeowner, let us in or get out. Man evicted from house for resisting warrantless inspections. This comes to us from WorldNet Daily at WND.com. A Pennsylvania man who refuses to allow city officials to enter his home without a warrant has been forced out to stay in a hotel instead, evicted by a notice posted on his door that forbids him from using or occupying the building he owns. Borough Ordinance Number 1188 of Lansdowne, Pennsylvania, requires all rental properties, including the private residence of the landlord, if he lives on site, be subjected to annual inspections with or without a warrant. But Michael Markovage, who lives in half of a Lansdowne duplex that he owns, renting out the other half, believes the city knocking on the door and demanding warrantless entrance and inspection of his private residence, just because it also happens to be part of a rental building, is a violation of the U.S. Constitution's Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment states in part, "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable search and seizure shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause." Markovage has not been accused of any wrongdoing, nor has any warrant been sought to inspect his property. In fact, he's been fighting the borough's rental inspection ordinance as unconstitutional for years, both for himself and his tenants. He's even been issued a citation and fine in the past for refusing to permit warrantless search of his home. But earlier this week, the borough stepped up the battle. 2 days ago, city code officials posted a notice on Markovich's door informing him his house was deemed an unlawful rental property and allowing him to the end of that same day to obtain his rental license or get out. Now Markovich is staying at a hotel, but he vows to fight the city's ordinance and actions in federal court if necessary. "I cannot and will not bow to these tyrannical actions by government officials," Markovich stated. "The notice posted on my front door was not only a notice to me, but a notice to all Americans that if you are unwilling to forsake your constitutional rights, the government will make you suffer." WorldNet Daily contacted Michael Joswiak, Lansdowne's Director of Zoning and Code Enforcement, who said Markovich's talk of inspections was putting the cart before the horse. "The notice says nothing about inspections," Joswiak explained. "Mr. Markovich failed to file for his rental license, and that's the reason for the notice." But Markovich told WND the dispute still comes down to mandatory entrance into his home and the homes of his tenants. He intentionally refused to sign the renewal forms Joswiak alluded to because they required compliance with the city's warrantless search ordinance. "I could not, in good conscience, agree to the terms of a license renewal, thus signing away my Fourth Amendment rights," Markovich said. "I explained this to Mr. Joswiak and sent him U.S. Supreme Court rulings demonstrating that the city's ordinance is unconstitutional. I even offered to file the necessary forms unsigned." Markovich highlighted the 1967 Camara v. Municipal Court of City and County of San Francisco case, in which the Supreme Court overturned conviction of a tenant for refusing a housing code inspection. "We hold that administrative searches of the kind at issue here are significant intrusions upon the interests protected by the Fourth Amendment," the court ruled. "That such searches, when authorized and conducted without a warrant procedure, lack the traditional safeguards with which the Fourth Amendment guarantees to the individual." Markovich also told WND that he is seeking an injunction that would enable him to move back into his home without violating the notice posted on his door and possibly risking an arrest. "We've got to defend our rights," Markovich said, "especially after the Supreme Court's recent decisions on eminent domain." Markovich also pointed to a case in Red Wing, Minnesota, to argue that it's not just renters and landlords that need to be concerned about the erosion of the Fourth Amendment. In the 2006 case of Stewart versus City of Red Wing, landlords similarly rejected the city's attempt to require warrantless code inspections. During the case, however, it was discovered city officials were considering the inspection of rental properties as only a first step before seeking the ability to inspect all private residences in the city. Though Red Wing has since explicitly backed away from the plan to inspect all homes, Markovich warns Americans need to remain vigilant. "I believe it was Thomas Jefferson," Markovich said, "who warned of government encroaching on our rights, not all at once, but in increments." Lansdowne Bureau maintains an email and phone list on its homepage for those wishing to contact city officials. I believe it was also Thomas Jefferson that said, "A government big enough to give you anything that you want is also big enough to take away anything that you have." So I do believe that government should be limited as much as possible. I think in this case, the city in question does not have a right to inspect these rental properties. If they want to inspect a rental property that is empty, that's a different story. If they are inspecting a property that is occupied, then I do think they need a warrant. Sending random city officials into the home of someone, there's no safeguard there that says the city official doesn't have a grudge against the resident of that particular location. So I don't think that's the right thing to do. Okay, on to the ninth story. Alamogordo police pay $21,000 to settle open carry lawsuit. This comes to us from the Examiner. As reported in the Alamogordo Daily News today, the Alamogordo, New Mexico police have paid $21,000 to settle a suit with Matthew St. John, whom police detained for open carrying a holstered handgun at a movie theater. This settlement follows a host of settlements by police departments around the country with plaintiffs who were detained by police for openly carrying a holstered handgun, including Pennsylvania, Louisiana, Virginia, and Georgia. More cases are still pending in Ohio, Georgia, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. On September 8, 2009, Federal District Judge Bruce D. Black issued an order previously examined here that concluded as a matter of law that Alamogordo police officers violated Matthew St. John's constitutional rights under the Fourth Amendment because they seized and disarmed him even though there was not any reason to believe that a crime was afoot. Judge Black's opinion is consistent with numerous high state and federal appellate court rulings, including the United States Supreme Court, holding that there is no firearms exception to the Fourth Amendment. Judge Black has designated his September 8, 2009 opinion and order to be published in the Official Reporter of the United States Federal District Court for New Mexico. While unpublished opinions can be cited in the future by litigants in other courts, a published opinion is viewed as having more weight as a source of law than unpublished opinions. The case can now be cited as St. John v. McCauley et al., F sub 2D, 2009, and a bunch of letters and numbers that you don't care about. Alamogordo Department of Public Safety Director Sam Trujillo, or some crazy Spanish or Mexican pronunciation, and President of the New Mexico Association of Chiefs of Police, told Examiner.com today that his department will be examining the case with an in-house counsel with an eye toward refining police procedures and training to ensure that police officer contacts with open carriers do not offend the Fourth Amendment's protection against unreasonable search and seizure. Mr. Trujillo said his department will attempt to identify what circumstances, if any, under the law of trespassing New Mexico, police officers may act on behalf of private property owners to ask people carrying guns to leave private property, or if the private owner or his agent must provide this notice. The open carry of holstered handguns is legal in 42 states and requires no license in New Mexico and 25 other states. Hey, the guy wasn't doing anything with the gun, he just happened to be carrying it. I don't think there's any reason to arrest him based on that. If he was carrying it in an unsafe manner, maybe. But it sounded like he had an actual holster to put it in. It wasn't like he just tucked the gun into the waistband of his pants. So, I'm glad the police department got slapped down on this one. Okay, on to the next one. Court won't review Florida Pledge of Allegiance law. This one is from the AP. I found it through Google. The Supreme Court has rejected an appeal to review a Florida law that requires public school students to recite the Pledge of Allegiance each day unless they have their parents' written permission excusing them. The justices declined Monday an appeal filed by the American Civil Liberties Union of Florida on behalf of a high school student removed from his math class because he remained seated during the pledge. A federal appeals court upheld most of the law. The ACLU said that ruling, if left undisturbed, would undermine the Supreme Court's 1943 ruling that school children could not be forced to salute the flag and say the pledge. Florida argued that the law, by giving parents the right to have their children excused, does not violate the First Amendment. I'm actually not going to say anything on that one. If you've got opinions, feel free to send them in, and I will read them on the show. And our last story of the day. Yes, this is story number 11. It turns out that Detroit is a good place to speed. And this one comes to us thanks to Kobach via Jalopnik.com. Faced with dwindling resources, overcrowded prisons, and much more significant crimes, Detroit police are now ignoring traffic infractions. Below, ABC News describes an incident where Detroit's police chief let someone driving without a license go with merely a warning. "He certainly is a legitimate arrest," said Detroit Police Chief Warren Evans of that licenseless driver. But is it worth being out of service for an hour and a half in an area where the priority runs could be significant in that hour and a half? ABC News also reports that the in-car cameras and computers in most squad cars don't work, so officers can't record traffic stops, run license plates, and check for warrants. So, basically, speeding is now fair game in the city of Detroit. We plan on putting this to the test. And for those of you who don't know, Jalopnik is a website that is all about the automotive industry in the United States. So they probably will really put it to the test and drive very fast around Detroit. I think the police department and the residents of the city of Detroit would be a lot better served if, instead of ignoring traffic offenses, the Detroit police ignored drug offenses. You know, that way the people that just want to peacefully smoke their marijuana at home or at their friend's home can do so without fear of being arrested, and the idiots that drive at 110 miles an hour through crowded city streets with a 35 mile an hour speed limit and end up crashing into people because they're not able to stop when the light in front of them turns red will be the ones that are, stopped from doing that kind of behavior, and maybe life in Detroit will be a little bit safer. So that's my news, or my opinion on this news. And that is the last story of the night. So if you've got comments, opinions, news stories you would like to hear read on the show, send them in to zenovalent@aim.com. Let's see what else is in the show format. Links. I guess I should give you some links. Of course, there is rantmedia.ca for the inspiration for all of this. You should check out wognetwork.com and 90degreestudios.com, who are projects run by Kobach, who sent in the last story of the night. And that's about it. I don't have any recommended media. So this is me saying good night.
Good night, everyone.